butterfly's dance?
Karu looked up. God, no. I think he makes my butterflies barf.
Susanna had just taken a sip of tea, and her hand flew to her mouth in an effort to keep it in. She laughed, doubled over, until she managed to swallow.
Gross! Your stomach is full of butterfly barf.
Karu laughed too, and kept sketching. Actually, I think my stomach is full of dead butterflies. Kaz killed them.
She wrote, Papiliostomachus. Fragile creatures, vulnerable to frost and betrayal.
So what? Said Susanna. They had to be pretty stupid butterflies to fall for him anyway. You'll grow new ones, with more sense. New wise butterflies.
Karu loved Susanna for her willingness to play out such silliness on a long kite string.
Right.
She raised up her teacup in a toast. To a new generation of butterflies, hopefully less stupid than the last. Maybe they were burgeoning even now in fat little cocoons. Or maybe not. It was hard to imagine feeling that magical tingling sensation in the pit of her belly anytime soon.
Best not to worry about it, she thought.
She didn't need it. Well, she didn't want to need it.
Yearning for love made her feel like a cat that was always twining around ankles, meowing, pet me, look at me, love me.
Better to be the cat gazing coolly down from a high wall, its expression inscrutable. The cat that shunned petting, that needed no one. Why couldn't she be that cat? Be that cat, she wrote, drawing it into the corner of her page, cool and aloof. Karu wished she could be the kind of girl who was complete unto herself, comfortable in solitude, serene. But she wasn't. She was lonely, and she feared the missingness within her as if it might expand and cancel her. She craved a presence beside her, solid, fingertips light at the nape of her neck, and a voice meeting hers in the dark. Someone who would wait with an umbrella to walk her home in the rain, and smile like sunshine when he saw her coming, who would dance with her on her balcony, keep his promises, and know her secrets, and make a tiny world wherever he was, with just her in his arms, and his whisper, and her trust. The door opened. She looked in the mirror and suppressed a curse. Slipping in behind some tourists, that winged shadow was back again. Karu rose and made for the bathroom, where she took the note that Kishmish had come to deliver. Again, it bore a single word. But this time the word was, please.
Chapter 11.
Please.
Please. Brimstone never said please.
Hurrying across town, Karu found herself more troubled than if the note had said something menacing like, now or else. Letting her in, Issa was uncharacteristically silent.
What is it, Issa? Am I in trouble?
Hush. Just come in and try not to berate him today.
Berate him?
Karu blinked. She'd have thought if anyone was in danger of being berated, it was herself.
You're very hard on him sometimes. As if it's not hard enough already.
As if what's not hard enough?
His life. His work. His life is work. It's joyless. It's relentless. And sometimes you make it harder than it already is.
Me?
Karu was stunned.
Did I just come in on the middle of a conversation, Issa? I have no idea what you're talking about.
Hush, I said. I'm just asking that you try to be kind, like when you were little. You were such a joy to us all, Karu. I know it's not easy for you, living this life. But try to remember. Always try to remember. You're not the only one with troubles.
And with that, the inner door unsealed and Karu stepped across the threshold. She was confused, ready to defend herself, but when she saw Brimstone, she forgot all that. He was leaning heavily on his desk,
his great head resting in one hand, while the other cupped the wishbone he wore around his neck. Kishmish hopped in agitation from one of his master's horns to the other, uttering crickety chirrups of concern, and Karu faltered to a halt.
Are you okay?
It felt odd asking, and she realized that all of the questions she had barraged him with in her life, she had never asked him that. She'd never had reason to. He scarcely ever shown a hint of emotion, let alone weakness or weariness. He raised his head, released the wishbone, and said simply,
"You came."
He sounded surprised, and Karu thought guiltily, relieved. Striving for lightness, she said, "Well, please is the magic word, you know."
"I thought perhaps we had lost you."
"Lost me? You mean you thought I died?"
"No, Karu. I thought that you had taken your freedom."
"My..." She trailed off. "Taken her freedom? What does that even mean?"
"I always imagined that one day, the path of your life would unroll at your feet and carry you away from us, as it should, as it must. But I am glad that day is not today."
Karu stood staring at him. "Seriously? I blow off one errand and you think that's it? I'm gone forever? Jesus, what do you think of me, that you think I'd just vanish like that?"
"Letting you go, Karu, would be like opening the window for a butterfly. One does not hope for the butterfly's return."
"I'm not a freaking butterfly."
"No. You're human. Your place is in the human world. Your childhood is nearly over."
"So, what, you don't need me anymore?"
"On the contrary. I need you now more than ever. As I said, I'm glad that today is not the day you leave us."
This was all news to Karu, that there would come a day when she would leave her Chimera family, that she even possessed the freedom to do so if she wished. She didn't wish. Well, maybe she wished not to go on some of the creepier errands, but that didn't mean she was a butterfly fluttering against glass trying to get out and away. She didn't even know what to say. Brimstone pushed a wallet across the desk to her. The errand. She'd almost forgotten why she was here. Angry, she grabbed the wallet and flipped it open. Dirhams. Morocco, then. Her brow furrowed. "Ezeal?" she asked, and Brimstone nodded. "But it's not time." Karu had a standing appointment with the grave robber in Marrakesh the last Sunday of every month, and this was Friday, and a week early.
"It is time,"
said Brimstone. He gestured to a tall apothecary jar on the shelf behind him. Karu knew it well. Usually it was full of human teeth. Now it stood nearly empty. "Oh." Her gaze roved along the shelf, and she saw, to her surprise, that many of the jars were likewise dwindling. She couldn't remember a time when the tooth supply had been so low. "Wow, you're really burning through teeth. Something going on?" It was an inane question, as if she could understand what it meant that he was using more teeth when she didn't know what they were for to begin with.
"See what Ezeal has," Brimstone said. "I'd rather not send you anywhere else for human teeth, if it can be helped."
"Yeah, me too." Karu ran her fingers lightly over the bullet scars on her belly, remembering St. Petersburg, the errand gone horribly wrong. Human teeth, despite being in such abundant supply in the world, could be interesting to procure. She would never forget the sight of those girls, still alive in the cargo hold, mouths bloody, other fates awaiting them next. They may have gotten away. When Karu thought of them now, She always added a made-up ending, the way Issa had taught her to do with nightmares so she could fall back to sleep. She could only bear the memory if she believed she'd given those girls time to escape their traffickers, and maybe she even had. She'd tried. How strange it had been, being shot. How unalarmed she'd found herself. How quick to unsheathe her hidden knife and use it. And use it. And use it. She had trained in fighting for years, but she had never before had to defend her life. In the flash of a moment, she had discovered that she knew just what to do.
"Dry Gemma Elfana," Brimstone said. "Kishmish spotted Izil there, but that was hours ago, when I first summoned you. If you're lucky, he might still be there."
And with that, he bent over his tray of monkey teeth, and Karu was apparently dismissed. Now there was the old Brimstone, and she was glad. This new creature who said please and talked about her like she was a butterfly? He was unsettling. "I'll find him," Karu said. "And I'll be back soon, with my pockets full of human teeth." Huh. I bet that sentence hasn't been said anywhere else in the world today. The wishmonger didn't respond, and Karu hesitated in the vestibule. "Brimstone," she said, looking back. "I want you to know I would never just leave you." When he raised his reptilian eyes, they were bleary with exhaustion.
"You can't know what you will do," he said,
and his hand went again to his wishbone.
"I won't hold you to that."
Issa closed the door, and even after Karu stepped out into Morocco, she couldn't shake the image of him like that, and the uneasy feeling that something was terribly wrong. Chapter 12. Something Else Entirely. Akiva saw her come out. He was approaching the doorway, was just steps from it when it swung open, letting loose an acrid flood of magic that set his teeth on edge. Through the portal stepped a girl with hair the improbable color of lapis lazuli. She didn't see him, seeming lost in thought as she hurried past. He said nothing but stood looking after her as she moved away, the curve of the alley soon robbing him of the sight of her and her swaying blue hair. He shook himself, turned back to the portal, and laid his hand on it. The hiss of the scorch, his hand limned in smoke, and it was done. The last of the doorways that were his to mark. In other quarters of the world, Hazael and Laraz were finishing too, and winging their way towards Samarkand. Akiva was poised to spring skyward and begin the last leg of his journey to meet them before returning home, but a heartbeat passed, then another, and still he stood with his feet on the earth, looking in the direction the girl had gone. Without quite deciding to do it, he found himself following her. How, he wondered, when he caught the lamplit shimmer of her hair up ahead, had a girl like that gotten mixed up with the Chimera? From what he'd seen of Brimstone's other traders, they were rank brutes with dead eyes, stinking of the slaughterhouse. But her? She was a shining beauty, lithe and vivid, though surely this wasn't what intrigued him. All of his own kind were beautiful, to such an extent that beauty was next to meaningless among them. What, then, compelled him to follow her? When he should have taken at once to the sky, the mission so near completion? He couldn't have said. It was almost as if a whisper beckoned him onward. The Medina of Marrakesh was labyrinthine, some 3,000 blind alleys intertwined like a drawer full of snakes, but the girl seemed to know her route cold. She paused once to run a finger over the weave of a textile, and Akiva slowed his steps, veering off to one side so he could see her better. There was a look of unguarded wistfulness on her pale, pretty face, a kind of lostness. But the moment the vendor spoke to her, it transmuted to a smile like light. She answered easily, making the man laugh, and they bantered back and forth, her Arabic rich and throaty, with an edge like a purr. Akiva watched her with hawk-like fixedness. Until a few days ago, humans had been little more than legend to him. And now here he was in their world. It was like stepping into the pages of a book alive with color and fragrance, filth and chaos. And the blue-haired girl moved through it all like a fairy in a story, the light treating her differently than it did others, the air seeming to gather around her like held breath, as if this whole place were a story about her. Who was she? He didn't know, but some intuition sang in him that whoever she was not just another of Brimstone's street-level Grim Reapers. She was, he was sure, something else entirely. His gaze unwavering, he prowled after her as she made her way through the Medina. Chapter 13. The Grave Robber. Karu walked with her hands in her pockets, trying to shake her uneasiness about Brimstone. That stuff about taking her freedom? What was that about? It gave her a creeping sense of impending aloneness, like she was some orphaned animal raised by do-gooders, soon to be released into the wild. She didn't want to be released into the wild. She wanted to be held dear, to belong to a place and a family irrevocably.
"Magic healings here, Miss Lady, for the melancholy bowels," someone called out to her,
and she couldn't help smiling as she shook her head in demurral. How about melancholy hearts, she thought. Was there a cure for that? Probably. There was real magic here among the quacks and touts. She knew of a scribe dressed all in white who penned letters to the dead and delivered them, and an old storyteller who sold ideas to writers at the price of a year of their lives. Karu had seen tourists laugh as they signed his contract, not believing it for a second. But she believed it. Hadn't she seen Stranger Things? As she made her way, the city began to distract her from her mood. It was hard to be glum in such a place. In some derbs, as the wending alleyways were called, the world seemed draped in carpets. In others, freshly dyed silks dripped scarlet and cobalt on the heads of passers-by. Languages crowded the air like exotic birds. Arabic, French, the tribal tongues. Women chivied children home to bed, and old men in tarbouche caps leaned together in doorways, smoking. A trill of laughter, the scent of cinnamon and donkeys, and color. Everywhere color. Karu made her way toward the Gemma al-Fana, the square that was the city's nerve center, a mad, teeming carnival of humanity. Snake charmers and dancers, dusty barefoot boys, pickpockets, hapless tourists, and food stalls selling everything from orange juice to roasted sheep's heads. On some errands, Karu couldn't get back to the portal fast enough. But in Marrakesh, she liked to linger and wander. Sip mint tea, sketch, browse through the souks for pointy slippers and silver bracelets. She would not be lingering tonight, however. Brimstone was clearly anxious to have his teeth. She thought again of the empty jars, and furious curiosity strummed at her mind. What was it all about? What? She tried to stop wondering. She was going to find the grave robber after all. And his zeal was nothing if not a cautionary tale.
"Don't be curious,"
was one of Brimstone's prime rules, and his zeal had not obeyed it. Karu pitied him, because she understood him. In her, too, curiosity was a perverse fire, stoked by any effort to extinguish it. The more Brimstone ignored her questions, the more she yearned to know. And she had a lot of questions. The teeth, of course. What the hell were they all for? What of the other door? Where did it lead? What exactly were the Chimera, and where had they come from? Were there more of them? And what about her? Who were her parents, and how had she fallen into Brimstone's care? Was she a fairy tale cliche, like the firstborn child in Rumpelstiltskin, the settlement of some debt? Or perhaps her mother had been a traitor strangled by her serpent collar, leaving a baby squalling on the floor of the shop. Karu had thought of 100 scenarios, but the truth remained a mystery. Was there another life she was meant to be living? At times, she felt a keen certainty that there was, a phantom life, taunting her from just out of reach. A sense would come over her while she was drawing or walking, and once, when she was dancing slow and close with Kaz, that she was supposed to be doing something else with her hands, with her legs, with her body. Something else. Something else. Something else. But what? She reached the square and wandered through the chaos, her movements synchronizing themselves to the rhythms of mystical Nawa music as she dodged motorbikes and acrobats. Billows of grilled meat smoke gusted thick as houses on fire. Teenage boys whispered hashish, and costumed water sellers clamored, "Photo, photo." At a distance, she spotted the hunchback shape of Aziel among the henna artists and street dentists. Seeing him at one-month intervals was like watching a time-lapse of decline. When Karu was a child, he was a doctor and a scholar, a straight and genteel man with mild brown eyes and a silky mustache he preened like plumage. He had come to the shop himself and done business at Brimstone's desk, and, unlike the other traders, he always made it seem like a social call. He flirted with Issa, brought her little gifts, snakes carved from seed pods, jade drop earrings, almonds. He brought dolls for Karu, and a tiny silver tea service for them. And he didn't neglect Brimstone either, casually leaving chocolates or jars of honey on the desk when he left. But that was before he'd been warped by the weight of a terrible choice he'd made, bent and twisted and driven mad. He wasn't welcome in the shop anymore, so Karu came out to meet him here. Seeing him now, tender pity overcame her. He was bent nearly double, his gnarled olive wood walking stick all that kept him from collapsing on his face. His eyes were sunk in bruises, and his teeth, which were not his own, were overlarge in his shrunken face. The mustache that had been his pride hung lank and tangled. Any passerby would be taken with pity. But to Karu, who knew how he had looked only a few years earlier, he was a tragedy to behold. His face lit up when he saw her.
"Look who it is, the wishmonger's beautiful daughter, sweet ambassadress of teeth. Have you come to buy a sad old man a cup of tea?"
"Hello, Aziel. A cup of tea sounds perfect," she said, and led him to the cafe where they usually met.
"My dear, as the month passed me by, I'm afraid I'd quite forgotten our appointment."
"Oh, you haven't. I've come early."
"Ah, well, it's always a pleasure to see you. But I haven't got much for the old devil, I'm afraid."
"But you have some?"
"Some."
Unlike most of the other traders, Aziel neither hunted nor murdered. He didn't kill at all. Before, as a doctor working in conflict zones, he had access to war dead whose teeth wouldn't be missed. Now that madness had lost him his livelihood, he had to dig up graves. Quite abruptly, he snapped,
"Hush, thing! Behave, and then we'll see."
Karu knew he was not speaking to her, and politely pretended not to have heard. They reached the cafe. When Aziel dropped into his chair, it strained and groaned, its legs bowing as if beneath a weight far greater than this one wasted man.
"So," he asked, settling in, "how are my old friends, Issa?"
"She's well."
"I do miss her face. Do you have any new drawings of her?"
Karu did, and she showed them to him.
"Beautiful."
He traced Issa's cheek with his fingertip.
So beautiful. The subject and the work. You are very talented, my dear.
Seeing the episode with the Somali poacher, he snorted.
Fools. What Brimstone has to endure, dealing with humans.
Karu's eyebrows went up. Come on, their problem isn't that they're human, it's that they're subhuman.
True enough. Every race has its bad seeds, one supposes. Isn't that right, beast of mine?
This last bit he said over his shoulder, and this time a soft response seemed to emanate from the air. Karu couldn't help herself. She glanced at the ground, where Azeel's shadow was cast crisp across the tiles. It seemed impolite to peek, as if Azeel's condition ought to be ignored, like a lazy eye or birthmark. His shadow revealed what looking at him directly did not. Shadows told the truth, and Azeel's told that a creature clung to his back, invisible to the eye. It was a hulking, barrel-chested thing, its arms clenched tight around his neck. This was what curiosity had gotten him. The thing was riding him like a mule. Karu didn't understand how it had come about. She only knew that Azeel had made a wish for knowledge, and this had been the form of its fulfillment. Brimstone warned her that powerful wishes could go powerfully awry. And here was the evidence. She supposed that the invisible thing, who was called Razgut, had held the secrets Azeel had hungered to know. Whatever they were, surely this price was far too high. Razgut was talking. Karu could make out only the faintest whisper, and a sound like a soft smack of fleshy lips.
No, Azeel said. I will not ask her that. She'll only say no.
Karu watched, repelled, as Azeel argued with the thing, which he could see only in shadow. Finally, the grave robber said,
all right, hush. I'll ask.
Then he turned to Karu and said apologetically,
he just wants a taste. Just a tiny taste.
A taste? She blinked. Their tea had not yet arrived. Of what?
Of you, wish daughter. Just a lick. He promises not to bite.
Karu's stomach turned. No?
I told you, Azeel muttered. Now will you be quiet, please?
A low hiss came in response. A waiter in a white jalaba came and poured mint tea, raising the pot to head height and expertly aiming the long stream of tea into etched glasses. Karu, eyeing the hollows of the grave robber's cheeks, ordered pastries, too, and she let him eat and drink for a while before asking, so, what have you got? He dug into his pockets and produced a fistful of teeth, which he dropped on the table. Watching from the shadow of a nearby doorway, Akiva straightened up. All went still and silent around him, and he saw nothing but those teeth, and the girl sorting through them in just the way he knew the old beast sorcerer did. Teeth. How harmless they looked on that tabletop. Just tiny, dirty things plundered from the dead. And if they stayed in this world where they belonged, that was all they'd ever be. In Brimstone's hands, though, they became so much more than that. It was Akiva's mission to end this foul trade, and with it, the devil's dark magic. He watched as the girl inspected the teeth, with what was clearly a practiced hand, as if she did this all the time. Mixed with his disgust was something like disappointment. She had seemed too clean for this business, but apparently she was not. He'd been right, though, in his guess that she was no mere traitor. She was more than that, sitting there doing Brimstone's work. But what?
God, Azeel, said Karu. These are nasty. Did you bring them straight from the cemetery?
Mass grave. It was hidden, but Razgut sniffed it out. He can always find the dead.
What a talent. Karu got a chill, imagining Razgut leering at her, hoping for a taste. She turned her attention to the teeth. Scraps of dried flesh clung to their roots, along with the dirt they'd been exhumed from. Even through the filth, it was easy to see that they were not of high quality, but were the teeth of a people who had gnawed at tough food, smoked pipes, and been unacquainted with toothpaste. She scooped them off the table and dropped them into the dregs of her tea, swishing it around before dumping it out in a sodden pile of mint leaves and teeth, now only slightly less filthy. One by one, she picked them up. Incisors, molars, canines. Adult and child alike.
Ezeal, you know Brimstone doesn't take baby teeth.
You don't know everything, girl,
he snapped. Excuse me?
Sometimes he does. Once he wanted some.
Karu didn't believe him. Brimstone strictly did not buy immature teeth, not animal, not human. But she saw no point in arguing. Well, she pushed the tiny teeth aside and tried not to think about small corpses in mass graves. He didn't ask for any, so I'll have to pass. She held each of the adult teeth, listening to what their hum told her, and sorted them into two piles. Ezeal watched anxiously, his gaze darting from one pile to the other.
They chewed too much, didn't they? Greedy gypsies. They kept chewing after they were dead. No manners. No table manners at all.
Most of the teeth were worn blunt, riddled with decay, and no good to Brimstone. By the time Karu was through sorting, one pile was larger than the other. But Ezeal didn't know which was which. He pointed hopefully to the larger pile. She shook her head and fished some dirham notes out of the wallet Brimstone had given her. It was an overly generous payment for these sorry few teeth, but it was still not what Ezeal was hoping for.
So much digging, he moaned. And for what? Paper with pictures of the dead king? Always the dead staring at me.
His voice dropped.
I can't keep it up, Karu. I'm broken. I can barely hold a shovel anymore. I scrabble at the hard earth, digging like a dog. I'm through.
Pity hit her hard. Surely there are other ways to live.
No. Only death remains. One should die proudly when it is no longer possible to live proudly. Nietzsche said that, you know. Wise man. Large mustache.
He tugged at his own bedraggled mustache and attempted a smile. Ezeal, you can't mean you want to die.
If only there was a way to be free.
Isn't there? She asked earnestly. There must be something you can do. His fingers twitched, fidgeting with his mustache.
I don't like to think of it, my dear, but there is a way. If you would help me. You're the only one I know who's brave enough and good enough. Ow!
His hand flew to his ear and Karu saw blood seep through his fingers. She shrank back. Razgut must have bitten him.
I'll ask her if I want monster,
cried the grave robber.
Yes, you are a monster. I don't care what you once were. You are a monster now.
A peculiar tussle ensued. It looked as if the old man were wrestling with himself. The waiter flapped nearby, agitated, and Karu scraped her chair back clear of flailing limbs both visible and invisible.
Stop it! Stop!
Ezeal cried, wild-eyed. He braced himself, raised his walking stick, and brought it back hard against his own shoulder and the thing that perched there.
Again and again he struck, seeming to smite himself. And then he let out a shriek and fell to his knees. His walking stick clattered away as both hands flew to his neck. Blood was wicking into the collar of his jalaba. The thing must have bitten him again. The misery on his face was more than Karu could bear, and without stopping to consider, she dropped to his side, taking his elbow to help him up. A mistake. At once she felt it on her neck. A slithering touch. Revulsion juddered through her. It was a tongue. Razgut had gotten his taste. She heard a loathsome gobbling sound as she lurched away, leaving the grave robber on his knees. That was enough for her. She gathered up the teeth and her sketchbook.
"Wait, please,"
Izio cried.
"Karu, please."
His plea was so desperate that she hesitated. Scrabbling, he dug something from his pocket and held it out. A pair of pliers. They looked rusted, but Karu knew it wasn't rust. These were the tools of his trade, and they were covered in the residue of dead mouths.
"Please, my dear," he said. "There isn't anyone else."
She understood at once what he meant, and took a step back in shock.
"No, Izio. God, the answer is no."
"A bruxis would save me. I can't save myself. I've already used mine. It would take another bruxis to undo my fool wish. You could wish him off me. Please, please."
A bruxis. That was the one wish more powerful than a Gavriel, and its trade value was singular. The only way to purchase one was with one's own teeth. All of them. Self-extracted. The thought of pulling her own teeth out one by one made Karu feel woozy. "Don't be ridiculous," she whispered, appalled that he would even ask it. But then, he was a madman, and right now he certainly looked it. She retreated.
"I wouldn't ask. You know I wouldn't. But it's the only way."
Karu walked rapidly away, head down, and she would have kept walking and not looked back but for a cry that erupted behind her. It burst from the chaos of the Gemma al-Fana and instantly dwarfed all other noise. It was some mad kind of keening, a high, thin river of sound unlike anything she had ever heard. It was definitely not Izil. Unearthly, the wail rose, wavering and violent, to break like a wave and become language. Susurrus, without hard consonants. The modulation suggested words, but the language was alien even to Karu, who had more than 20 in her collection. She turned, seeing as she did that the people around her were turning too, craning their necks, and that their expressions of alarm were turning to horror when they perceived the source of the sound. Then she saw it too. The thing on Ezeel's back was invisible no more. Chapter 14. Deadly Bird of the Soul. If the language was alien to Karu, it was not so to Akiva.
"Sorry. I see you,"
rang the voice.
"I know you, brother, brother. I have served my sentence. I will do anything. I have repented. I have been punished enough."
Akiva stared in blank incomprehension at the thing that materialized on the old man's back. It was all but naked, a bloated torso with reedy arms wrapped tight around the human's neck. Useless legs dangled behind, and its head was swollen taut and purple, as if it were engorged with blood and ready to pop in a great wet burst. It was hideous. That it should speak the language of the Seraphim was an abomination. The absolute wrongness of it held Akiva immobile, staring, before the amazement at hearing his own language turned to shock at what was being said in it.
"They tore off my wings, my brother."
The thing was staring at Akiva. It unwound one arm from the old man's neck and reached toward him, imploring.
"Twisted my legs so I would have to crawl like the insects of the earth. It has been 1,000 years since I was cast out. 1,000 years of torment. But now you have come. You have come to take me home."
Home? No. It was impossible. People were shrinking away from the sight of the creature. Others had turned, following the direction of its supplication, to fix their eyes on Akiva. He became aware of their notice and swept the crowd with his burning gaze. Some fell back, murmuring prayers, and then his eyes came to rest on the blue-haired girl, some 20 yards distant. She was a calm, shining figure in the moiling crowd, and she was staring back. Into coal-rimmed eyes and a sun-bronzed face, fire-colored eyes with a charge like sparks that seared a path through the air and kindled it, it gave Karu a jolt. No mere startle, but a chain reaction that lashed through her body with a rush of adrenaline. Her limbs came into the lightness and power of sudden awakening. Fight or flight, chemical and wild. Who? She thought, her mind racing to catch up to the fervor in her body. And what? Because clearly he was not human, the man standing amid the tumult in absolute stillness. A pulse beat in the palms of her hands, and she curled them into fists, feeling a wild hum in her blood. Enemy. 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 The knowledge pounded through her on the rhythm of her heartbeat. The fire-eyed stranger was the enemy. His face, oh beauty, he was perfect. He was mythic, was absolutely cold. She was caught between the urge to flee and the fear of turning her back on him. It was Ezeel who decided her.
"Melek!"
he screamed, pointing at the man.
"Melek!"
"Angel. Angel?"
"I know you. Deadly bird of the soul, I know what you are."
Ezeel turned to Karu and said urgently,
"Karu, wish daughter, you must get to Brimstone. Tell him the Seraphim are here. They've gotten back in. You must warn him. Run, child, run."
And run she did. Across the Jemma al-Fana, where those attempting to flee were being hampered by those drawn to the commotion, she shouldered her way through them, knocked someone aside, spun off a camel's flank, and leapt over a coiled cobra, which struck out at her, defanged and harmless. Hazarding a glance over her shoulder, she could see no sign of pursuit, no sign of him, but she felt it. A thrill along every nerve ending, her body alert and alive. She was hunted. She was prey. And she didn't even have her knife tucked into her boot, little thinking she'd need it on a visit to the grave robber. She ran, leaving the square by one of the many alleys that fed into it like tributaries. The crowds in the souks had thinned, and many lights had been snuffed, and she raced in and out of pools of darkness, her stride long and measured and light, her footfall nearly silent. She took turns wide to avoid collisions, glanced behind again and again, and saw no one. Angel. The word kept sounding in her mind. She was nearing the portal. Just one more turn, the length of another blind alley, and she would be there, if she made it that far. rushing from above. Heat and the bass woomph of wingbeats. Overhead, darkness massed where a shape blotted out the moon. Something was hurtling down at Karoo on huge, impossible wings. Heat and wingbeats and the skirr of air parted by a blade. A blade. She leapt aside, felt steel bite her shoulder as she slammed into a carved door, splintering slats. She seized one, a jagged spear of wood, and spun to face her attacker. He stood a mere body's length away, the point of his sword resting on the ground. Oh, thought Karoo, staring at him. Oh, angel indeed. He stood revealed. The blade of his long sword gleamed white from the incandescence of his wings. Vast, shimmering wings, their reach so great they swept the walls on either side of the alley, each feather like the wind-tugged lick of a candle flame. Those eyes. His gaze was like a lit fuse, scorching the air between them. He was the most beautiful thing Karoo had ever seen. Her first thought, incongruous but overpowering, was to memorize him so she could draw him later. Her second thought was that there wasn't going to be a later, because he was going to kill her. He came at her so fast that his wings painted blurs of light on the air, and even as Karoo leapt aside again, she was seeing his fiery imprint seared into her vision. His sword bit her again, her arm this time, but she twisted clear of a killing thrust. She was quick. She kept space around her. He tried to close it, and she danced clear, lissome, fluid. Their eyes met again, and Karoo saw past his shocking beauty to the inhumanity there. The absolute absence of mercy. He attacked again. As quick as Karoo was, she couldn't get clear of the reach of his sword. A strike aimed at her throat glanced off her scapula instead. There was no pain. That would come later, unless she was dead. Only spreading heat that she knew was blood. Another strike, and she parried it with her slat of wood, which split like kindling, half of it falling away so she held a mere dagger's length of old wood, a ridiculous excuse for a weapon. Yet when the angel came at her again, she dodged in close to him and thrust, felt the wood catch flesh and sink in. Karoo had stabbed men before, and she hated it, the gruesome feeling of penetrating living flesh. She pulled back, leaving her makeshift weapon in his side. His face registered neither pain nor surprise. It was, Karoo thought as he closed in, a dead face. Or rather, the living face of a dead soul. It was utterly terrifying. He had her cornered now, and they both knew she wouldn't get away. She was vaguely aware of shouts of amazement and fear up the alley and from windows, but all of her focus was on the angel. What did it even mean, angel? What had Ezeel said? The seraphim are here. She'd heard the word before. Seraphim were some high order of angels, at least according to the Christian mythos, for which Brimstone had utter contempt, as he did for all religion.
"Humans have gotten glimpses of things over time," he'd said. "Just enough to make the rest up. It's all a quilt of fairy tales, with a patch here and there of truth."
"So what's real?" she'd wanted to know.
"If you can kill it, or it can kill you, it's real."
By that definition, this angel was real enough. He raised his sword, and she just watched him do it, her attention catching for a moment on the bars of black ink tattooed across his fingers. They were fleetingly familiar, but then not, the feeling gone as soon as it registered. And she just stared up at her killer and wondered numbly, why? It seemed impossible that this was the final moment of her life. She cocked her head to the side, desperately searching his features for some hint of soul.
And then she saw it. He hesitated. Only for a split second did his mask slip. But Karu saw some urgent pathos surface, a wave of feeling that softened his rigid and ridiculously perfect features. His jaw unclenched, his lips parted, his brow furrowed in an instant of confusion. At the same moment, she became aware of the pulse in her palms that had made her curl her hands into fists at her first sight of him. It thrummed there still, a pent-up energy, and she was jolted by the certainty that it emanated from her tattoos. An impulse overcame her to throw up her hands, and she did, not in cringing surrender, but with palms powerfully out-thrust, inked with the eyes she'd worn all her life without ever knowing why. And something happened. It was like a detonation, a sharp intake, all air sucked into a tight core and then expelled. It was silent, lightless. To the gape-jawed witnesses, it was nothing at all, just a girl throwing up her hands. But Karu felt it, and the angel did too. His eyes went wide with recognition in the instant before he was flung back with devastating force to hit a wall some 20 feet behind him. He crumpled to the ground, wings askew, sword skittering away. Karu scrambled to her feet. The angel wasn't moving. She spun and sprinted away. Whatever had happened, a silence had risen from it, and it followed her. She could hear only her own breathing, weirdly amplified like she was in a tunnel. She rounded the bend in the alley at speed, skidding on her heel to avoid a donkey standing stubborn in the middle of the lane. The portal was in sight, a plain door in a row of plain doors, but something was different about it now. A large black handprint was burned into the wood. Karu flung herself at it, hammering with her fists in a frenzy such as she had never unleashed on a portal before.
"Issa!" she screamed. "Let me in!"
A long, awful moment, Karu looking back over her shoulder. And then the door finally swung open. She started to dart forward, then let out a choked cry. It was not Issa or the vestibule, but a Moroccan woman with a broom. Oh, no. The woman's eyes narrowed and she opened her mouth to scold, but Karu didn't wait. She pushed her back inside and shoved the door closed, staying outside. Frantically, she knocked again.
Issa!
She could hear the woman shouting and feel her trying to push the door open. Karu swore and held it shut. If it was open, the magic of the portal couldn't connect. In Arabic, she hollered, "Get away from the door!" She looked over her shoulder. There was a commotion in the street, arms waving, people shouting. The donkey stood unimpressed. No angel. Had she killed him? No. Whatever had happened, she knew he wasn't dead. He would come. She pounded on the door again.
"Issa! Brimstone, please!"
Nothing but irate Arabic. Karu held the door closed with her foot and kept pounding.
"Issa! He's going to kill me! Issa, let me in!"
What was taking so long? Seconds hung like scuppies on a string, vanishing one after another. The door was jumping against her foot, someone trying to force it open. Could it be Issa? And then she felt a draft of heat at her back. She didn't hesitate this time but turned, jamming her back up against the door to hold it closed, and raised her hands as if to let her tattoos see. There was no detonation this time, only a crackling of energy that raised her hair like Medusa's serpents. The angel was stalking toward her, head lowered so he was looking at her from the tops of his burning eyes. He didn't move with ease, but as if against a wind. Whatever power in Karu's tattoos had hurled him against that wall, it hindered him now, but didn't stop him. His hands were fists at his sides, and his face was ferocious, set to endure pain. He stopped a few paces away and looked at her,
really looked at her, his eyes no longer dead, but roving over her face and neck, drawn back to her Hamsa's and again to her face, back and forth, as if something didn't add up.
"Who are you?"
he asked, and she almost didn't recognize the language he spoke as Chimera. It sounded so soft on his tongue.
Who was she?
Don't you usually find that out before you try to kill someone? At her back, a renewed pressure at the door. If it wasn't Issa, she was finished. The angel came a step closer, and Karu moved aside so the door burst open.
Karu!
Issa's voice, sharp, and she spun and leapt through the portal, pulling it shut behind her. Akiva lunged after her and yanked it back open, only to come face to face with a hollering woman who blanched and dropped her broom at his feet. The girl was already gone. He stood there a moment, all but unaware of the madness around him. His thoughts were spinning. The girl would warn Brimstone. He should have stopped her, could easily have killed her. Instead, he'd struck slowly, giving her time to spin clear, dance free. Why? It was simple. He'd wanted to look at her. Fool. And what had he seen, or thought he'd seen? Some glimpse of a past that could never come again? The phantom of the girl who had taught him mercy, long ago, only to have her own fate undo all her gentle teaching? He thought every spark of mercy was dead in him now, but he hadn't been able to kill the girl. And then, the unexpected, the Hamsas. A human marked with the devil's eyes. Why? There was only one possible answer, as plain as it was disturbing, that she was not, in fact, human. Chapter 15. The Other Door. In the vestibule, Karu fell to her knees. Breathing hard, she leaned into the coil of Issa's serpent body.
Karu!
Issa gathered her into an embrace that left them both sticky with blood.
What happened? Who did this to you?
You didn't see him?
Karu was dazed. See who?
The angel. Issa's reaction was profound. She reared back like a serpent ready to strike and hissed.
Angel?
All her snakes, in her hair, around her waist and shoulders, writhed along with her, hissing. Karu cried out, her wounds wrenched by the violent motion.
Oh, my dear, my sweet girl, forgive me.
Issa softened again, cradling Karu like a child.
What do you mean, angel? Surely not.
Karu blinked up at her. Shadows were closing in.
Why did he want to kill me? Darling, darling,
Issa fretted. She pulled away Karu's sword-slashed coat and scarf to see her wounds, but the blood was heavy and still flowing, and the light in the vestibule was dim.
So much blood.
Karu felt as if the walls were swinging in a slow arc around her. She was waiting for the inner door to unseal, but it didn't.
Can we go in?
Her voice was faint.
I want Brimstone.
She remembered how he'd picked her up and held her when she came in bleeding from St. Petersburg, how she'd felt perfect trust and calm, knowing he would fix her. And he had, and would again. Issa bunched up Karu's blood-soaked scarf and tried to staunch her wounds.
He's not here right now, sweet girl.
Where is he?
He can't be disturbed.
Karu whimpered. She wanted Brimstone, needed him. She said,
disturb him.
And then she was losing herself. Drifting. Falling. Issa's voice, far away. And then nothing. By and by, flickering images like badly spliced film, Issa's eyes and Yasri's, close, anxious. Soft hands, cool water, dreams. Ezeal and the thing on his back, its blue.